And this program, may I remind you, is not a good bottle of wine, but a discourse on something scientific, though it can be a bottle of wine as well. Much to my surprise, I found it on the menu at one of my favourite restaurants. There it was, Occam's Razor, a Shiraz from Heathcote in Victoria. And on the back label, it even had William of Ockham's famous observation put this way: what can be done with fewer is done in vain with many more. Or keep it simple, stupid, as they say these days. By the way, the wine was excellent too. Which brings us to grass, and a regular user of Occam's Razor, if not to trim his lawn, Peter McInnes, who's been reading a favourite poet.
I agree with Dorothea McKellar. When it comes to vegetation, it's the wide brown land for me. No field, no coppice, no manically manicured croquet lawn for me, thanks. If there has to be a clearing in the undergrowth, let it be a Darwinian gap, a place where all the organisms have a roughly equal go. I say roughly equal because I'm an organism and I claim the right to play the Darwin game too. I reserve my right to be unkind to kikuyu, or to take a cleaver to the clover to stop it flowering and bringing bees to sting bare feet. I'll pluck bindii and uproot double G's, but I won't poison plants that merely blemish the lawn. Those doing so cheat just as much as people who paint their animals before exhibiting them. Like Cromwell, I prefer warts and all. So prima facie, I may not appear to be a good candidate to write a social history of the lawn. Or am I? To write truthfully about a culture, it helps to be an outsider. Only somebody who's cast off the shackles of lawnism can see it for what it is. A fish can't discover water, and no courtier could see that the emperor's new clothes were non-existent. Only an external observer can do that. I'm a lapsed botanist who likes grass, but not lawn. Grass is a bit of an anarchist, a survivor, a symbol of egalitarian democracy, but lawn's subservient. Lawn plants are repressed masses, regimented and controlled, forced to conform. Lawn frightens me because it sets a bad example in its docile acceptance of the mower's harsh cuts. But it's another of my characteristics that best qualifies me for the task. Robin Williams once labelled me a fact fossicker, and I've rather taken that title to heart. I don't just fossick facts, though. I chase them down burrows, I drag them screaming into the light, and I pin them down in databases. Every book I write begins as a flat file database, with each entry existing as a single line in a spreadsheet. Over about a dozen columns, I store the data that let me sort, compare, annotate, and collate. The basic data structures are set, so I can transfer ideas from one place or book to another. Last year, I published a look at science and technology as it was in 1859. Mr. Darwin's Incredible Shrinking World examined the many changes that accompanied the emergence of The Origin of Species in 1859, 150 years ago. My database lets me sort and compare oddities and link them together, but there was one very obvious trend. A huge number of lawn sports emerged within a year or so of 1859. The first international cricket tour happened, several codes of football were established, croquet became popular, and cap it all, lawn tennis was first played in 1859. Just diverging for a moment, one of the earliest references I've found so far to the word fossick is in an article in the Perth Gazette of July 2, 1852, where it was described as a new term. The article was probably copied from an earlier Eastern paper, and I suspect the word celebrates a Vandemonian whose name was Fossick, but that's as far as I've got. The point of all fossicking, though, is poking around in the hope of striking gold. The link between sports and 1859 was just such a golden find, a case of chance favouring the prepared fossicking mind. There was probably something else going on in the late 1850s, something related to muscular Christianity and the idea of a healthy mind in a healthy body. But sport would have been quite different, were it not for one thing. The first ever patent for a lawnmower was issued in 1830. That expired in 1855, and by 1859 new designs were flooding the market, machines that made smooth lawns free of the uneven patches a scythe might leave, even in expert hands. More importantly, the new lawns were free of animal droppings. Before the lawnmower, lawns were trimmed by animals. In 1859, Prince Albert was turning a handsome profit, £2,000 a year, running scrawny cattle and sheep on the parks of London. They kept the grass down, even as the animals grew fat, sleek and saleable, but the end was coming for park animals. Sheep continued to be used in some places, but most sports were soon being played on dung-free pitches. Most, that is, but not all. In the 1860s, a famous runner named Colbeck, quote, "Once won a quarter-mile championship, beat a record and broke the leg of an awe-stricken sheep at one and the same time." Beat that, you molly, coddled modern athletes. The late 1850s and early 1860s saw major new city parks like Central Park in New York and Amsterdam's Vondelpark enabled by the mower. They were inspired by Joseph Paxton's Birkenhead Park, not far from Liverpool, opened in 1842, and Paxton's landscaping of the area around the Crystal Palace in 1852 to 1856, after it was moved from Hyde Park to make room for the stock to return. Frederick Law Olmsted, who played a major role in the design of Central Park, visited Birkenhead in 1850 and was enraptured by it. After the US Civil War, he created a suburb in Chicago called Riverside, and for the first time ever, front lawns were a major feature of home design. Riverside's lawns, however, would never feature sheep. Thorstein Veblen's conspicuous consumption era was dawning, and nobody in Riverside would have dreamt of having any animal of economic value on their lawn. Deer might be acceptable, given that George Washington used deer to maintain his rough lawn at Mount Vernon. Like English stately homes, Washington's grounds had a ha-ha, a fence set in a ditch so as to be invisible, while keeping the animals at a distance. Within the ha-ha, near the house, servants wielded scythes to trim the lawn. Riverside had no ha-has, no sheep, and no cattle. Here we meet a second aspect of lawn enthusiasm, the wish to ape the palaces of Europe and the grand university colleges in England with their immaculate lawns. Labour in Europe was cheap, so fine lawn was available to European aristocrats, but what about the middle classes in their suburbs in Chicago? Hired help was no longer cheap in America. Luckily, the lawnmower had arrived. Based on a device used to trim the nap, the rough bits on cloth, Edwin Budding's 1830 mower was a bit crude, but once the patent expired, designers had a free hand to improve on the original. Without mechanical mowers, lawn would probably never have caught on, but it did, and we had the ideal of a monoculture lawn dumped on us. Now we sought not the rough chamomile lawn that Sir Francis Drake played bowls on, but a slice of perfection. Sadly, perfection is a treadmill that lawnsmen can't get off. Sprays make the clippings poisonous, so they must go to landfill, carrying nutrients away. That means fertilizer must be bought. Fuel has to be expended. Drainage is needed, so water has to be added. It goes on, an orgy of waste that feeds no people, just egos. The crime that is lawn needed a means, a motive, and an opportunity. The means was the mower. The motive was a wish to be perceived as a person of considerable wealth, enough to own land without running a lucrative animal on it. Lawn was an advertisement of the owner's success in life. Public transport provided the opportunity. Commuter railways and steam trams let houses sprawl out enough to make room for lawns between the homes. In places like Chicago, the grass really only grows in summer, when there are long hours of daylight, allowing the suburbanite to arrive home and spend his leisure hours sweating furiously over the lawn, weeding, trimming, hauling water, raking and more. Note that I said his leisure hours. Most advertising, even in the 19th century, featured young females operating mowers, but mowing and lawnsmanship was and is almost entirely a male preserve. The females in the ads are all young and remarkably nubile, and most of them appear to be at grave risk of a wardrobe malfunction. They wear shoes that appear designed to aerate the lawn as they walk, but no sensible woman would mow attired like that, just as no sensitive man could allow any woman to operate the mower. Sexism is alive and well on green surfaces. The lawn's a boon to psychologists. Men, even mild-mannered men, will upbraid others who fail to mow their lawns. If the delinquent's too beefy and buffy, they might just slip an anonymous note in the letterbox. But lawns and dirty cars are about the only two things that cause the average male to attempt to dictate to another. No man feels ashamed of delivering such a reproof, even by stealth. Mind you, I've had a beard for almost all of the past 40 years, and just occasionally I've been given unsubtle hints by almost strangers that my facial hair needed trimming. There's a clear parallel buried in the male subconscious perception between beards and lawns. By an odd chance, Edwin Budding's middle name was Beard, and in 1881 William Robinson, an Irish writer on gardening, commented in his book The Wild Garden, We want shaven carpets of grass here and there, but what nonsense it is to shave it as often as foolish men shave their faces. Robinson, who also wrote for The Times, had a beard, and the paper shared his obsession even two generations later. One week after World War II ended, The Times conceded that some might resent the need to push a mower around on a sweltering afternoon. But, said the writer, the wild lawn which had erupted during the war was like a beard. Removing a beard was painful, and so was taking off the overgrowth of weeds. But once it is done, its owner rejoices in his newfound chin and fondles its unaccustomed smoothness. In short, the male critic of lawnism takes his life in his hands among the alpha males of suburbia. Luckily, my beard marks me as a harmless eccentric who can be ignored. The woman who mows the lawn is still likely to have some male come along and try to wrest control of the machine from her. It's a dark area, but let's move on to something even darker. Just over 3 years ago, a US Navy veteran in Ohio shot and killed a teenage neighbour for walking on his, the veteran's, lawn. When something like that happens, the obsession's gone too far. The dreams become a nightmare. The figures on lawn care may be a bit rubbery, but estimates put the cost of US lawns at between $25 and $40 billion, more than the GDP of half the world's nations. Until the last few years, I suspect that Australia may well have been close to per capita parity with the US. Now, with climate change, drought and water restrictions, we're slowly approaching sense. We simply can't afford the waste of water and other resources to chase a mad and embittered but unreachable ideal. Lawn and the desire for it drove the growth of Australian suburbia, based on the quarter-acre block. Having created the lawn, many felt impelled to be seen to amuse themselves on it or to decorate it. Just as Americans have plastic flamingos, Australians have tire swans. More to the point, lawns and lawnmowers shaped our society by exposing us to sports. My first draft of my book was completed during the Beijing Olympics, a festival of games performed largely on neatly trimmed grass. In the streets of Beijing, officials were sent out to paint the street grass green. Even as sports are moving onto artificial turf or synthetic surfaces, we sit indoors in our lawn-deficient homes, watching television as people do sport on those surfaces. Bowls players are also moving to synthetic surfaces, which are easier to maintain, but the new surfaces get hotter than grass, and they're more slippery when it rains. Players fainting in the heat or slipping in the wet will now fall on a less yielding surface, and more will be injured or even die. Without the lawn and the lawnmower, even those sports now played on synthetic surfaces could not have been established. We'd have no sports journalists, and perhaps literature and the arts would take a more prominent place in the news of the day. Strained groin headlines might give way to tales of writer's cramp, and bohemian romps might displace footballers' orgies from the front pages. Nobody could have seen back in 1830 just where Mr. Budding's invention was leading us. Now look ahead and wonder just where our changing attitudes to lawn will go in the next century and a half. I suspect that like codpieces, bustles and tail fins on 60s cars, the lawn will be looked on as a strange and passing aberration. The grass, however, will still be with us.
And so will your beard, I suspect, Peter. That's Peter MacInnis, born in 1859 and still going strong. His book, The Lawn, A Social History, has a solemn garden gnome on the cover, wearing a beard, of course. And I purposely put this talk on right in the middle of a deluge of rain in most states in Australia. Forgive me, Peter. But one bloke's not amused, Aristotle, as Jennifer Riggs in Brisbane tells you next week, with some musing on hard and soft sciences. I'm Robin Williams.